And hold your applause. Thank you, Les. Thank you very much for that boring introduction. I'd like to make a couple of announcements, if I may. One, I want to congratulate Keith Nottage for being here. He celebrated his birthday with open heart surgery. And one of the films on television tonight is The Black Dahlia. Steve, will you be watching and still protesting?
No, I won't be watching.
How many folks here, serious from that, how many folks here are looking forward to the day when they might have a novel that's published? Okay, I asked for a reason. I got in the mail yesterday. A wonderful book, How I Got Published. Famous authors tell you in their own words. There are about 100 or more authors. On the cover, they make mention of Gail Lins, who will be speaking here next month, and Sue Ann Jafarian, who most of you know, and this is me, and others. And Others is also in a new anthology out this month called Hollywood and Crime. So I'm doing real good. I'm getting some well-deserved recognition. One of the panelists who happens to be the program chairman, I'm going to show you how important I am to today's meeting, emailed about a month ago. And the email said, Bob, do you really still want to be the moderator of our panels? The three of us have done this before, and if you didn't want to do it, it would be okay.
That's because you were so busy, he said.
Yeah. It says here, the subject of the panel is amateur detectives, which really does, Patty, explain why I'm here. As everybody knows, my first series was built around a pizza delivery man. A pizza delivery man. All right.
You're intellectual for us.
And it says, crime fiction is replete with police officers or private investigators as crime-solving protagonists. But what currency can writers draw upon in plotting the actions of a civilian main character and not challenge the reader's willing suspension of disbelief? The panel will address the limitations and opportunities in the case of an amateur sleuth as hero. That's what it says here. But now on.
Say that.
To the real panel of the day. Let me introduce the three panelists, and then we'll get down to some serious business. Okay, I see.
Great.
Anything for the press. Susan Candell's debut novel, I Dreamed I Married Perry Mason, about biographer C.C. Caruso, was nominated for an Agatha and became a Los Angeles Times bestseller. The second, Not a Girl Detective, was selected as the best novel nominee by the Southern California Booksellers Association. Her third in the series is Shamus in the Green Room, and her fourth is Christytown. My favorite female author in the whole wide world, Susan Candell, she's right over there. Next up, sitting next to her, is an author whose debut novel, Dating Dead Men, about graphic artist and greeting card designer Willie Shelley, won many awards. Including the Agatha, Anthony, and the Cavity, and is followed by Dating is Murder and Dead X. Her short prose has appeared in Ms. Magazine, Soap Opera Digest, The Sun, The Santa Monica Review, and the anthologies Mystery Muses and This is Chick Lit. My favorite female author in the whole wide world, Harley Jane Kozak. And sitting to Harley's right is an author whose debut novel, False Prophets, about Los Angeles management consultant Tucker Sinclair, received a starred review from Booklist and was a BookSense recommendation. Her follow-up novel, Cover Your Assets, was a Romantic Times top pick. Both novels were Los Angeles Times bestsellers. Short Change is the third in the series, and of course, I'm talking about my favorite female author in the whole wide world, Patricia Smile. We're going to skip the part of the program where each one has an opportunity to explain why they love my wife. Harlan. I think the obvious question, so I'll start with you, is what in the world made you select as a protagonist the protagonist you did, Bully Shelton?
It's a good question, Bob. Thank you for asking. I didn't set out to write a mystery novel, and I definitely didn't set out to write a series. I thought I was writing literary fiction. What is now called, I guess, women's fiction, and this was before the days when the term chick lit was coined, which we're all familiar with. But I was taking a writing class, and an idea for a character just evolved from my best friend in fourth grade, Sharon Samick, in Lincoln, Nebraska, wrote me a letter and said that she was fulfilling her dream in life, which was to open Sharon's Hallmark card shop, and which subsequently went belly up a year later. But this was her dream in life, and just that one little comment started the ball rolling in my head of a character whose dream in life was such, to me, such a sweet and kind of naive and I mean, living in Hollywood where dreams are so grandiose, I thought, what a sweet little dream. And what if I were to set a character like that in the middle of a bad section of Hollywood, what would happen? So that was the start of my novel, and I used my bad dating experiences to give Wally, and I gave her like a part-time job. And then there was a dead body, and then that took over the plot, and then I sold the book thinking it was a standalone novel, and then my editor asked me for a sequel, and then a year later, two more. So that's how it happened. But I didn't set out to do it, and now I'm faced with the dilemma, which is the topic of today's brunch talk, which is, how do I keep doing this? It's so implausible.
Susan, how do you keep doing it?
Well, I don't know. I had to take a year off last year to recover. It was hard to do these books one a year, which is generally the pattern that the publisher wants you to do. One a year, one dead body at least every year. And that is when you sort of come up against the implausibility of the whole thing. And you start to realize, well, my amateur sleuth actually, you know, by book five, is not an amateur sleuth. She's already solved, you know, 4 to 7 murders. So, you know, she's actually a pro. She might have started off as an amateur.
Right.
So mine, you know, I'm trying to think maybe she, you know, is a part-time detective, part-time biographer of dead mystery writers. So how do you do it? Well, I think that you do it by trying to keep the particulars realistic while accepting that the overall notion that there is, you know, there's this consistent pattern of murder around this ordinary citizen, trying to accept that that is going to be functioning on a level of complete fantasy. You know, that is utterly nonsensical. But so that you don't lose the reader, because most of these readers come to these books as fans of mysteries, not as fans of fantasy, so you don't lose those readers, you try to keep the details
Christmas.
That's really well said.
Yeah. And next time you hear any of us speaking, we will be saying exactly those words and giving you a gift for it.
In that case, Patty, you know precisely what my next question will be. Go ahead.
Wait a second. The great Karnak. How I spent my summer vacation. No, I don't know what your question is.
How much of a scramble, if that's the word, was it for you when you decided you were going to sit down and write a novel to say, I want to do something different. I've got to pick a field or a character that nobody else is writing about. Is that what you did to come up with a management consultant, or what in fact did you do?
Oh my God, you must have read my mind. That's exactly what I thought, because, you know, I have always been a big fan of mystery fiction, and I decided not to do a PI or a police procedural because it had been done before by a lot of people, and I knew I'd have to be do a lot of research. And at the time, I didn't really want to do that. So I decided, because I had an MBA and because I had done some consulting, that I didn't know of any other novel that had exactly that kind of character in it. And so that's exactly what I did. I decided to make her an MBA, you know, someone with an MBA who worked in a large consulting firm in downtown LA, because I thought, okay, her ties to corporate America, she would never run out of crimes to solve. Every book, she would go into a new, you know, company and find new white-collar crime and new whatever. So that's what I did. I since, however, my books, there is an element, because in my books, when people die, the police investigate. And so I needed to find out about specifically Pacific Area, Pacific Division Police Station of the LAPD. I needed to find out what it looked like inside, because there's a scene in there in the first book, in False Prophets, that takes place in the police station. So what did I do? I went down and volunteered. And that was 12 years ago, and I'm now a specialist reserve officer for the LAPD. I have access to all of the technical information that I need, unless I need to ask Steve something, and then I give him a little call.
25-year-old information isn't going to help you.
Oh, okay.
Susan, why Perry Mason?
Why Perry Mason? Well, it all started 6 years ago. And I was in Ventura on vacation with my husband, who's sitting over there, who's my amanuensis, always there.
Yay,
when big things happen. I was not a mystery writer. I was not aspiring to be a mystery writer. I was a mystery reader, and I was an art critic. But we were on vacation in Ventura. We're taking this lovely stroll. We're having this romantic weekend. And we come across this beautiful old building on California and Maine on the corner. And we're sort of history buffs. We read the plaque. And the plaque says, this is the place where the character Perry Mason was born. And what we learned was this was the building where Earl Stanley Gardner had his law practice in the 20s. And where, hoping to make some extra money, he created this character, Perry Mason, and started writing stories about him. So really my whole mystery writing career started with that. I just started thinking, wow, it would be amazing if some interesting person, writer person, wrote a mystery that was set in this building, and it was, you know, somehow about Perry Mason, and it was maybe, you know, a contemporary person who found out that, you know, the character Perry Mason was created in this building, and some mystery ensued, and by the end of the weekend, you know, I kind of had a character and a plot, and I was writing that book. So it was not particularly a great interest in Perry Mason. It was more a kind of interest in history, in California history, and in, I guess, literary history that drew me to that character, to that place specifically, and then kind of to writing mysteries myself. And in fact, I had never read a Perry Mason book before that. I'd seen the TV show and liked the TV show, and, you know, was compelled to read the Perry Mason books after deciding to write a book about Perry Mason. And I don't get through too many of them. I must admit, I'm sure there are Perry Mason fans in this room, a lot of them, of the books, but for me, they're pretty hard going to read them. Yeah.
So good.
Thank you.
I'll tell you something you probably don't know. I call my gardener Perry Mason. Because what he does is a mystery. God bless. I'm a lawyer. Here you are, you've decided to write a novel, you've picked a character not in the mainstream. I'm going to assume here you've done your homework. What was your incentive to put those first words on paper and carry it through to the 300 or 400 pages or whatever you wound up writing? Were you committed?
Me, Bob?
One of you.
I know you're committed, Harley.
The brave. Harley, will do you simply because you had a very successful career as an actress and left that field and at some point decided to try your hand at writing.
It was more of an overlap than that. Technically, I still haven't left that field, but I was taking a short story class because I realized that in my mid-30s, I was looking at the handwriting on the wall for, you know, actresses in film and television and how the roles were dwindling and the quality of roles was dwindling, much less interesting to me in my career. And so writing sort of filled the gap for me that was created by the less interesting acting work I was getting. And so I was in a short story class and I was writing a character sketch that just kept going. I didn't know I was writing a novel for a while. And then once I did, I left the short story class at Santa Monica Community College, which was a great class, and then started to become a UCLA Extension course junkie. And over the course of 9 years, finished the book finally, but I was acting as I was doing that, and it was actually, you know, I did think I was going to finish it. I remember reading a lot of books on writing. Once I put in about, I don't know, 3 years, I thought, well, now I've got to finish it because I've invested so much time and energy into these people and this plot. And when I would hear people talk about their unpublishable first novels, I thought, I can't do that. I put in too much time. So I just kept rewriting it until it became publishable. And I didn't have any, you know, like, you know, big holy grail goal in mind. I did. As time went on, I became more determined that I've got to finish this and I've got to publish it because it's taken over my life.
And if I'm not mistaken, one of the people who tutored you, whose classroom was Melody Johnson. Melody Johnson, how? Did you? No.
Thank you.
Claire Carmichael.
No, Melody Johnson.
Does she have an alias?
No.
Sorry, Bob.
Okay, playing off something you said now. You've got this book, you're satisfied, it's publishable. You're satisfied. To all three of you, if you reached that point where you were satisfied, it was publishable. What brought two of you to that point, and all three, what was the next step you took looking for a publisher or what?
Well, I'll say that because, you know, I don't know about Susan, but Harley and I are both in writers' groups. And I was in that writers' group for 9 years. So during that period of time, you know, you have to withstand a lot of criticism. And so I did that. I would come home every Wednesday night and throw myself on the bed and weep. And my husband said, and I would say, oh, they hated it, they hate me, and it's awful. And he'd say, well, why don't you just quit? And I would look up and I would say, are you out of your freaking mind? Of course I'm not going to quit. So I had really gone through a whole series of a lot of criticism until I felt that that book was ready. And so after, you know, after it was ready, I did what all of you did and what all of you are going to do, and that is I sent it out to agents because I had set a goal, and the pressure for me to finish was I had set a goal, and I had in writing to say that I was going to publish this novel. And in my head, my thought was I wanted a New York publisher. I wanted a big publisher because I felt like that, for me personally, was a test of my ability. If I could get a New York publisher to publish my book, then I felt that somehow, in my warped sense, that somehow it was worthy of publication. So that's what I did. But that's I got a referral. I got a referral to a couple of agents. I asked people who might say, you know, take pity on this poor thing and read her book, and that's what I did. And I sent out a few query letters, but I made some direct contacts with agents.
Well, I had had no experience at all writing fiction before my first book. No workshops, no writing groups, no nothing. But I had years and years and years of experience writing criticism, publishing my nonfiction work in newspapers and magazines. So I was very comfortable with the idea of writing for other people, being edited, and meeting deadlines. And I'd never missed a deadline in, 15 years. So I said to myself, I'm going to write a novel now, and I'm going to have a year-long deadline. And at the end of this year, it's going to be done. And so I just did that. And I don't really know how I did it, but I think it was kind of stupidity and naivete. I just thought, I'm just going to push this like any other piece of writing, and I'm not going to have writer's block, and I'm not going to, do too much laundry, and I'm not going to be distracted, and I'm just going to do it. It's going to be my sole focus. And I did quit the job that I was doing. I was editing an art magazine, and I quit that job because I decided, I was doing this. This is what I was doing now, and so I did it. And it was a great year. It was really probably, it was the easiest of my books to write, that first one, because I felt like nobody was looking over my shoulder, really. I had no agent, I had no publisher, I had, nobody who even thought I could write a novel, and so I was kind of just doing it for myself, and it was very pleasurable, really, and freeing. And at the end of the year, I have a very good friend who's in the publishing business, so I had that gift that, most people don't have, and this woman was so generous to me, and she, she said, tell me when it's done, and I'll read it, and I'll give you my honest opinion. And she liked it, and so I was able to drop her name when I tried to get an agent. And I think that made all the difference in the world, because I had, the name of somebody at a big publishing house that said, this is an interesting manuscript. And so that helped me tremendously. So connections really matter, and if you have any connection, no matter how tenuous, take advantage of it, because that'll save you endless time and heartache.
Was it your friend who wrote the book?
My friend? No.
I thought we should make that change.
No, in fact, she was an audiobook. She worked for Time Warner in audiobooks, so it wasn't even, that she would have been in a position to buy the book.
And Patty, that writing class you mentioned, was that with Melody Johnson?
And Claire Carmichael was in there, too.
Ah, so you had the best of one world.
Yeah.
With two people. I realize, listening, that we really were talking to three amateur writers. Forgive me, amateurs, mm-hmm. because you were unpublished at that time, who were writing about amateur detectives in the field. You've now found yourself an agent, or you've found yourself a publisher, but the task isn't over for you guys yet, is it? You still have to get some recognition. What did that take in terms of your time or your activities? Any one of you want to start that? I'll look at you, Holly, because
okay.
I remember that you came to a Left Coast Crime, the book wasn't yet out, and nobody knew you.
Well, you knew me, Bob.
That's what I'm saying. Nobody. I know where I am in the spectrum.
Actually, that's a good point. I went to a lot of conferences as an aspiring writer, and when I had my manuscript, so I was used to going to taking copious notes. I files of notes from all the Left Coast Crimes and all the conventions. And there was one where Bob said to me, what are you doing? Where I was, saying hi to him in the hall and running off, and I said, I'm going to hear a panel. He said, oh, you have a book coming out. You don't have to go hear panels anymore. Now you get to just schmooze in the hallways. And I said, oh, I didn't realize that. So what Bob did, and many people actually from this group, Greg Hurwitz was another one, and Claire Carmichael, and for all I know, Melanie. Actually, you know, had lunch with me and said, here's what you have to do in terms of marketing and promotion. Chances are your publisher won't do this because you're a first-time novelist and they don't have really money for book tour. There's no reason to spend money on a first-time novelist. You know, you're kind of on your own. And so here's who you need to, you know, make cold calls to in terms of booksellers and so all the stuff that we do. And so I just made a list and, you know, I had to learn to pick up the phone and say, hi, my name's Harley Jane Kosser. I'm going to have a new novel coming out. And my publisher, who's your publisher? Doubleday. Then they would get, you know, marginally warmer because they get a lot of calls from people who do not have, you know, New York publishers. And so I would set up book tours in places across the country where I had family, and since I'm the youngest of 8 children, that covers a lot of the country. So then I would call up my family and say, can you scrounge up, you know, 25 friends and make them come to a book signing? Okay. Can I stay on your, you know, in your guest room? And enough of them said yes, and then I just, you know, used my frequent flyer miles and, you know, did that. And because it was, I was pretty organized about it, my publisher was excited because they see that, oh, I went to, you know, Des Moines and sold 25 books, and that is actually significant for a first-time novelist and in hardcover. So they started to pick up the rest of the tour, and then the next year they actually picked up the whole tab and sort of did what I had done, but a lot faster and more truncated. I would go to, you know, a weekend here and a weekend there, and that's how I did it.
Did that same kind of thing work for you?
Yeah, you know, I have a master's degree in business and with an emphasis in strategic planning. So you can tell that I had a marketing plan before I ever finished my book. And I did the same thing as Harley. I went to all these conferences. I still have notebooks full of notes about what to do. But even more, you know, anal retentive, I would type them up and hand them out to my writer friends and say, oh, look, this is a great idea. So one of the things that I did was, in my first book, is I made a list of everybody who knew me and wished me well, and some who didn't wish me well. But I made a huge list. And I'm talking about, you know, the guy who shampoos my hair at my hairdresser. I'm talking everybody, not just your friends and relatives, everybody. Because I was panicked that nobody but my mother would buy my books. And so I gave myself a little launch party at Dutton's, and on the day it was supposed to be, it was November, it was cold, it was rainy, and the wind was like 50 miles an hour. It was like a horrible, horrible day. And I thought, oh my God, nobody's going to come. But a lot of people did come. And so I did that all over, the same thing. Every place I went, I didn't go any place that I didn't know somebody. And I arranged to go to my hometown of Yakima, Washington. And the first thing I did is I walked into the library, to the adult services librarian, and I said, hi, I'm a native of Yakima, and my name is Patty Smiley, and I have a book coming out. And she said, oh, yeah? I said, yeah. You know, I tried to be really perky. I'm sure she wasn't very impressed because she didn't know anything about it. So, but in fact, she was instrumental in helping me organize the tour in Yakima. She had the NBC affiliate come out and tape an interview with me. She had 65 people at the library for a writer's conference. I had 2 book signings there, and I had an evening with Patricia Smiley at the local theater, the community theater. I mean, it was kind of silly, but it was very heartwarming. So I urge all of you, to go. Small towns are always looking for, you know, local girl makes good. And I know you've done that too. But so yeah, it's hard. It's really, really hard to get any attention from anyone because, as you all know, it's a very crowded market, and it's hard to find a hook that makes anybody interested in you.
Harley got out of town. Patty got out of town. How about you, Susan? Were you able to promote outside of the immediate market?
This is my hometown, so I don't have that hometown advantage because there's too many people from here and this is too big of a hometown. But I did get out with with each of the books, I've gone kind of up and down the West Coast. I haven't really made it to New York yet or to be much on the East Coast. And the publisher has been pretty good about sending me around, you know, nothing too extensive. 1 year I experimented and I splurged on hiring a PR person of my own to kind of see if that would make a difference and get me more. And to tell you the truth, it really didn't. You know, I spent a lot of money that year, and I have to say that it didn't really, aside from getting me like some local media in some of these places like Phoenix or, you know, Seattle, it didn't make a huge difference. So I think that unless you've reached maybe a certain level, I'm not sure it makes total sense to spend a lot of money outside of what your publisher is doing or what you can do for yourself. Yeah, it's just tough. I mean, people do all kinds of things. I know you two blog. You know, that's a really good thing. I am too lazy, I think. And I don't feel like I have enough time. And I'm also kind of nutty about my writing. Like, I'm afraid to blog because my writing, I'm so perfectionistic about it that I feel like if I put something out there, I'd want to polish it so many times that how could I possibly have a blog? I don't blog.
My problems.
Yeah. It's just, that would be my whole, yeah. You know, week would be getting my blog ready. And yeah. I don't know how I would do my work. But anyway, I admire you.
I don't do my work.
But, you know, that's a good thing. If maybe you're not a perfectionist enough to have a blog and you know, there are all kinds of things that you can do. You can get out there. You can get on the Hadassah circuit, you know, and you can go and you can speak to groups of women. I've done a little of that. Somehow I got on that circuit, and I'm invited to speak to all kinds of Jewish ladies all over Southern California, and I do that, and they love to read books, and they buy my books. There are all kinds of local libraries that will invite you. And just, you know, whenever you're invited to one thing, if you go and you are interesting, one lady tells another lady, and they all invite you. So, you know, just say yes to everything.
Yeah.
You know, no matter if you go, you know, no matter where it is, you know, and I've gone to some odd places and it's been good.
I have an unlisted blog. If that helps Anderson. How are we doing so far? Are we okay? Let's before I get back to the brilliant questions I've been throwing at our exceptional panel, maybe there's a question or two out there you might want to ask at this time. Anybody? Back there?
Well, you spent 9 years writing the first book, and then tell us a little bit about the journey doing the second book and the third book.
For me?
Starting with you, Harley, and then all three ladies.
Sure.
My editor, when she bought the book and called me up and said, congratulations, I love this book, and we'd like you to write a sequel, and I want this woman to be, you know, dating again and finding dead bodies. Basically the same book, only different. And I said, okay. And she said, when do you think you can have it done? And I said, I have no idea. I have no idea how fast I can write, because I had just been doing this leisurely writing journey, discovering what genre I'm in, you know, how many drafts, 17. And I said, I don't know. You know, the first one took me 9 years. She said, well, we like it faster than that. And I said, she said, how about 12 months? And I said, well, I just gave birth to twins. And she said, then how about 15 months? And I said, okay. And I did it. And I, you know, I got an au pair from Germany, and I hid, and I also had a 2-year-old, and I had I hid in a bathroom and wrote the book. The children thought I had left the house. Now they're smarter, but because it's many years later. But that's how I finished the second one. I honestly don't know. And there was a gap between the first and second book, and then number 3 and 4, because they were seeing how the first ones did in sales to see whether it was worth their time to ask me to write 2 more. And so I did get a year's break in between the first 2 and the second 2. And honestly, I don't know. I never know how I'm going to finish it. You know, I just don't. It's scary to me.
When False Prophets came out, they bought one book. And I thought that there had potential to be a series, but I was not expecting it to be a series, because remember that goal I wrote? It said a novel. It didn't say many, many novels. So I was just thinking in my head, a novel. But I was in this writers group at the time, and so they bought it. Time Warner Book Group bought the book. And but I was still in a writers group, so, you know. And the group was led by Elizabeth George, and she said, you know, you need to start another novel. And I said, oh, I know, but, you know, what if this is not successful, and you know, maybe nobody will buy it. And she said, I thought you were a writer. If you're a writer, you write. That's what writers do. They write. And I said, oh, all right. So I started writing this second novel, and it was a bit darker. And so I was going, oh, what happens? You know, everyone loves the first novel, and then they read the second novel, it's just a little darker. And she said, you know, get a life, get over it. So I wrote the second book, and many of you have heard this story, but my road to publication was quite rocky in the beginning. I lost 2 agents and 3 editors, one of whom died in the middle of the editing process. So I think all this turmoil, they sort of forgot that they didn't even ask me if I was writing a second book. And, you know, so the first book was sort of, you know, it sold a few copies. And so they thought, oh my God, we haven't asked her if she's even writing a second book. Well, luckily I was. And so my agent, they called my agent and they said, you know, we have to call Patty and ask her if she's writing a second book. And he said, wait a second. You can't call her and ask her that. And I said, okay. So he calls me up and he says, are you writing a second book? And I said, yes. And he said, well, when can you finish it? And it was sort of like 3/4 of the way done. And I said, I don't know, a year? No, it has to be like in 4 months. And I said, okay. So that's what happened to me.
Susan.
Well, when they bought my first book, they bought 3 books. It was a 3-book deal, and each book, you know, was due, and, you know, one year apart. So, and then they paid me, and I spent all the money. So, I was writing 2 more books, and they were going to be due, you know, 1 year later, 1 year later, and that was it. I couldn't give the money back. It was gone. So, I did it.
I'm curious how your amateur sleuths interact with the police. I mean, are they seen as a pain in the butt? Or, you know, I can't see the police cooperating too much with civilians. How do you handle that?
Well, I'll answer that because, you know, I work for the police department. I'm now assigned to the Detective Investigative Unit at LAX. So I work with these detectives. And I try, you know, my books are sort of lighthearted, but I try really, really hard never to make it unrealistic. So what happens in my books is that my character in general, so far anyway, is investigating something else. She is not investigating the murder, but the police are. So they're on parallel tracks. But of course, you know, at some point, they intersect, and what Tucker has been investigating really is involved with the murder, although neither of those people know that. And in the first book, Tucker meets a LAPD homicide detective from Pacific Division who is really quite a sexy, you know, fun guy. And it's interesting because I was very concerned about the people I work with thinking, you know, that this was not realistic. And so, a lot of them have read my book, and all of them say, you know, when the sexy detective comes up, they all say, you know, when Joe Deegan said that, you got that from me, didn't you? And everybody who asks me, I have the same answer, yeah. So that's what I do. I really try to make the police, and I do not ever make Tucker confront the police and tell, and I try not to make them look stupid because they aren't stupid. I really do try to do that.
Beth, do you have a question?
Maybe a good one.
Oh, I would just say in my books, Wally usually is pursuing her own, you know, agenda of solving the mystery, and, you know, for whatever reason she is, whatever personal, you know, stake she has in it, and mostly tries to avoid the police, who are on a, you know, their own path, and they of course intersect, and like Patty, I try to not make them stupid. But usually they have a different, you know, game going. So the one reason she tries to avoid the police is she has a personal character trait of she's unable to lie at all. So she's, you know, she sweats, she blushes, she can't do it. So she tries to stay away from them because generally they serve as another impediment for her rather than, you know, something she's, you know, cooperating with. And then she gets involved with an FBI agent, so that's a whole other law enforcement thing. And then I explore the relationship between the FBI and the local police, and, you know, so that's another thing. So I try to do a lot of research too, but then in the end it's a lighthearted book, and, you know, it doesn't have much to do at all with the police.
Unless you had a question.
Yeah, it really goes along the lines of something Bob said earlier when you're talking about, so why do these bodies keep showing up around these people? Do there have to be bodies? Does there have to be a murder, do you think, in today's market? Sherlock Holmes, you know, there was probably 20% of the cases were murders, and the rest were other things.
I think there has to be a murder.
I think especially in these books, they're being so lighthearted, I think that they would kind of veer over to total fluff if maybe there weren't any dead bodies. I think maybe a different type of mystery than the ones that we write could get away with this. You know, if you were doing something maybe more psychological or something different, maybe you could have an element of fear or danger. But I think for us, I don't know, or maybe for me, I think you do have to have it somehow grounds it in some kind of mystery.
I also think it's the fashion and the reader's expectation now. I think that wasn't true in, you know, the days of Dorothy L. Sayers, maybe, but I don't think people have, if they're reading in the genre that I write in, I think they definitely expect a dead body or the possibility of one.
And soon. I'm always getting from my editor, you know, why is there no dead body? It's page 10. You know, I want a dead body.
I don't know if there has to be a dead body or not. Probably not if you could really handle it skillfully. I don't really think there has to be one. But it certainly raises the stakes because death is really the ultimate stakes. And I think although all of us have dead bodies, I don't think any of us really make fun of the dead in our books.
No.
Well, except Harley, I don't know. But yeah, there are bodies in all of mine. In mine, all of my books have... Every book has gotten progressively more serious, and I don't know what it is about that, but that's what's happening. And the fourth book, which I just finished, and will come out...
Good for you.
I know. It's really kind of serious. Very serious. I don't know what that's all about. But.
The idea of a willing suspension of disbelief, is that actually a problem in your writing, or do you people know you're amateur? They kind of, like Murder, She Wrote, you know, it kind of expect it, and you don't question it if it's done well. Do you find that, or do you find that people say, oh, that could never happen?
You know, I'm going to jump in here first very quickly. I think that the character, the amateur sleuth, the most important thing is in your character sketch before you even begin. What kind of character that you are writing about, and all of our characters are similar and different. But I think you have to explain to yourself, you have to know what that person really is like and all their life experiences. How many of you in here, just out of curiosity, think that you could actually solve a crime? Gail asked me that once, and that was a great question. Does anybody really feel that they could solve a crime? Yeah. Well, you can't. You ratted, you cheated. You wouldn't think you had me. But I feel like I could really solve a crime. I really do. And, you know, my character's cautious sometimes, not always, but I think that's the key, knowing who your character is and having written that down in stone before you begin writing. And I think that that makes sense.
I also think, very much like having a really strong conscience.
Yeah.
You know, like an almost obsessive need to do the right thing, and then putting them in situations where the right thing is to, you know, go to the next room and then, you know, out the window and then down the road and, you know, just keep following this trail that leads to the dead body and to have a personal stake in it. So my character has a, you know, she has a brother that's dependent on her and, you know, friends that she's passionate about. So it's usually on behalf of someone who's very close to her that she finds herself embroiled in this. And
Oh, I was going to say, you know, I mean, think about all the movies that you've seen where, you know, it's the dark hallway and everyone is screaming, don't go down that hallway. You know, it's implausible in real life. Would you go down that dark hallway? You know, would your character, you know, go down the dark alley, you know, all alone at 2 a.m. because she sees, you know, a cat, you know, who needs rescuing or whatever? No, but it's the pact that you make as an author with your reader when you open this kind of book. You know that you want a certain experience, and you are willing to kind of let reality go a little bit because you get something out of that experience. You get, you know, your heart rate, you know, speeds up, and you kind of want that. In a way, you want that implausibility because it's not something you would do in real life. These books are an escape from real life. You know, and part of the pleasure, I think, of the Amateur Sleuth book is that you get to find a character who's maybe a little bit like you, that you can identify with, and yet this person does things you would never do. And you get to kind of live vicariously through that.
Can I add one thing?
No.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Something that occurred to me, like for normal people like all of us who are leading normal lives, There are points along your life where you go, you know, that one month that was the most amazing month that weird thing happened. Or, you know, there's like that one highlighted incident in every life, or maybe a couple. And so I always think of myself as I'm writing about that one week in Wally's life that was so extraordinary and the weirdest combination of events. And it just so happens that I've done it 4 times. Like, she's had 4 of those over the course of 2.5 years. But I kind of just have to forget about that. Like, the book I'm writing is just that one astonishing week and a half in her life.
That's
it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
If she changes her diet, would she have a more steady life?
I don't know. That's a great question.
Don't try it.
I had that, to your question back there, producer-writer of Murder, She Wrote is sitting over there. Mm-hmm. So let's ask him. Tom, would you move to Cabot Cove?
every year the crew would give us, put together some little gift. And one of my prized possessions is a mug, coffee mug, that I use almost daily. And on one side, it says, Cabot Cove Coroner. On the other side, it says, if you lived here, you'd be dead by now.
Thank you, Tom. In the last year or so, I've noticed that there appears to have been a shift from what we would traditionally call the mystery to what we now call the thrill. In my case, whenever a new term comes along, I just start calling my book by the term, which is how, since I attended a romance writers conference in New Orleans last month, I discovered I'm really a romance writer. with that apparent shift, there seems to be fewer and fewer authors who are starting out with the concept of a series, and more who are saying, I'm writing a standalone. If this book sells and I'm fortunate enough to get the next book, I don't have to deal in that same milieu with the same characters. I can start something fresh. Has it entered your mind that perhaps you might be in a position at some point to make that kind of switch from series to standalone? We can start with you, Patty.
Okay. Well, actually, it's very interesting because I met with my editor a few months back. And we were talking, and she said to me, have you ever thought about writing a standalone? And I said, my first book was a standalone, but that's another story. And, you know, when they say that, at the time, I was just finishing my fourth book, and she said, do you have any ideas? And at that time, I had no idea in my head. I didn't even know how I was going to get back to the hotel. You know, so I said, I don't know. I guess I never thought about it, which is not the right thing to say. So be prepared. If anybody ever asks you this question, you will say, yes, I have an idea for a thriller called... And it's very much like the ones Bob Levinson writes. In fact, perhaps he might collaborate with him. No.
Still my heart.
So anyway, she brought that up to me. And I know I was just talking to you about that, and the same thing happened to you, and you already know the answer to that. But anyway, yeah. I think it's certainly any of that's possible if you have an interest in it.
I've always had an interest in this. I've got like three other book ideas, maybe five other book ideas. But Jeff Parker, T. Jefferson Parker, said to me, if you want to write a standalone, why don't you do it while you're writing your series? Because that'll make your editor happy, assuming, you know, that my editor wants me to keep writing these. And then you won't have to, you know, worry about the either or. And I said, that would be great, but, you know, what about my children? So,
I'm completely open to the idea of doing that, not of abandoning my children either, but, you know, maybe alternating. You know, I have, my publisher also had said to me, you know, are you interested in doing something other than the series? And I'm certainly, I feel like I haven't exhausted my series at all, and I'd like to go on with my series, but I, you know, I'm open to trying something different, you know, maybe when my children are older, care for themselves.
Harley, was that T. Jefferson Parker?
Yes. Is that what I said?
Well, I just wanted to be sure.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Would that be the same T. Jefferson Parker whose quote is on the cover of my next book out in March?
Wow. Oh, I believe it is him.
And who says?
Now that's Melanie Johnson Howe.
Pure Levinson, smart, dark, and funny. Levinson's vision of human foible has never been sharper.
Oh, wow.
Smart, dark, and funny.
Wow. Was there another question out there? If you had to give, based on your now expansive experience, had to give a few words of advice to the folks out there who are thinking about writing a book, struggling with a book, having finished a book, and wondered how the heck are they going to get an agent or a publisher, what would that piece of advice be? We'll start with Susan.
Oh, God.
All right, we'll start with Pat.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Marry an editor.
Great advice. Really good.
Yeah, you know, I've said this so many times because my road to publication was really quite long and bumpy. So I think my advice always to everybody, and I always say this, is don't give up. But don't stop working on your craft either. Don't think just because you've written a book and you've gotten some rejections that you could keep sending it out 150 times more without really looking at the criticism you're getting. I've told this before, but when I started getting back some rejection letters, I made a spreadsheet of yes, I did. And I had things like voice, you know, plot, blah blah, and I made marks of all the criticisms that fell, and if they were bunched, all of them were bunched in a certain area, I thought, okay, it's not really them, it's probably me, and maybe I should look at that area. So don't give up, but don't stop working on your craft. Don't stop learning. Don't stop trying to perfect your manuscript.
And I'll say almost the opposite thing, which is when the rejections come in, and of course they will, assuming that you've done the work before then, and like Patty, I do have a writer's group. I did, you know, those 300 courses at UCLA Extension. I read my novel to anybody who'd sit still long enough to, you know, listen to pieces of it. I took everybody's advice prior to sending it out. Once I sent it out, I did get some rejection letters that were, some of them were, frankly, incomprehensible, and then a lot of them were form letters. But I would say when you're putting yourself out there for criticism, figure that some of the people are going to be useful in their criticism of you, and then a lot of them are just not going to be useful at all. And for me, the road here, and it continues for me, is to figure out which criticism to listen to and which to say, you know what, they want me to be writing a different book, or they're not interested in my style or voice, and they never will be. And to really make a distinction between those two things, and just, you know, keep plowing through and know that someone out there is going to respond to you and find them.
Ask Bob Levinson for a blurb.
When I admire, I hate to do much talking, but I'm going to remark about that. I was very fortunate with the first book, which was six going on seven ago, in that the publisher went after blurbs. I really didn't have a concept of what blurbs were at the time. And blurbs came in from Clive Cussler, Nelson DeMille, Joe Lansdale, who had just won an Edgar that year, and some other people. And I believe they helped launch that first book and what I and others laughingly call my career. and the nice thing is, having been having had an opportunity since to pay back, I really believe that's important. But it's also important to know that people like Clive Cussler got his start almost the same way, with blurbs from authors of the time that he was starting out, and he's constantly paid back on that basis. I also want to remark, because Debbie's here, and the subject of PR came up earlier, something I know a bit about. If you're a writer, I believe your focus should be on writing. And if you're going to look into PR, you should be sure to do a couple of things. One, talk to a professional in the field who understands what it is you might need. Two, understand what it is you want. Don't wait to be told. And three, spend an amount of money that you're comfortable with. But it's certainly, PR is something you should look into, not ignore, because the truth is you get very little of that support from publishing houses today. I think we're very, very lucky that we have in this chapter people like Patty Smiley, Harley Jane Kozak, Susan Kandel, who are not only terrific writers, they were willing to give up their time the way they have today to help those of us understand a little better this crazy world of publishing. So I want to thank you, and I want you to know that when the house gives me the great applause I deserve, I'm sharing it with you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Patty Smiley, our program chair, for putting together the program, even though Bob did all the work, we know. Debbie is here with books. Buy them. Bring them up to be signed. I guess you're probably willing to talk to your actual fans. So we'll see you next month when the real Melody Howe Johnson will be.
Or Johnson Howe.
Johnson Howe, excuse me.
Okay. That was wonderful, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.